am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, friend. I'm so glad you're back with me. Now, before we go anywhere today, let me remind you where we are, because this isn't one of my usual wanders through the wide gallery of history. We're in the middle of something. A single story told in seven parts. We began with Abby Kelly Foster, the seed, then Frances Willard, who took that seed and grew it into a network stretched clean around the world. And last time, I took you to New Zealand in 1893 to stand beside Kate Shepard as she watched that network bear its first full fruit, women voting for the first time in a self-governing country. Today, we stay in that same New Zealand, same year, same victory, but we're going to watch it through a different door. Because Kate Shepard was never the only woman standing at that threshold. And the one I want you to meet today didn't come to the vote from a platform. She came to it from a factory floor. I want you to picture a room full of noise, not shouting, machines, rows of them, treadles pumping, needles going so fast the thread seems to disappear before it catches light. Cut cloth stacked in gray and brown bolts along one wall. The air close and warm, smelling of oil and wool, and the particular dust that only comes from cutting fabric all day, every day, for years. This is a South Island clothing factory sometime after 1906, and I am standing in the doorway with a woman I already know very well. She's not young anymore. Her hair is going the way hair goes. She's carrying a ledger under one arm like it weighs nothing, though I happen to know exactly how much weight is actually in it. She is the first woman this country has ever appointed to walk into a room like this one and inspect it. Not sew in it, not sweep it, inspect it. The hours, the wages, the safety of it, on the government's own authority. Watch the manager's face. Go on, watch it. I always do. There's a particular arithmetic that happens behind a man's eyes in that first half second. A woman in his doorway, sent by Wellington, here to look at his books. He recovers quickly. Men usually do. He'll offer her tea in a moment and be perfectly correct and privately furious. But watch the floor instead. Watch the women. Heads lift one after another down the rows, not all at once like a wave finding its rhythm. A look passes between two women at the nearest table, quick, and I don't think you'd catch it if you weren't looking for it. Because some of these women already know her name. They knew it from union meetings a decade and a half ago. They knew it from a fight over a weekly wage that used to be smaller than it is now, before someone spent years insisting it get bigger. They are looking at the woman in the doorway the way you look at someone you've been waiting for, even if you didn't know you were waiting. She hasn't said a single word yet, and already something in that room has shifted. So how does a tailor's daughter from Dunedin end up standing in that doorway with that ledger? And that particular kind of quiet authority. That part of the story starts a long way from any factory floor at all. I want to take you back further first, to 1867 or maybe 1874. The records don't fully agree, and small mercies, I was busy elsewhere and can't settle it for you myself. A family arrives in New Zealand from Macarrafelt, a market town in the north of Ireland. Among them, a girl not yet out of childhood named Harriet. Her father, James Morrison, is a master tailor, and so before Harriet is old enough to have opinions about her own life, her hands already know a needle. She becomes a tailoress herself in Dunedin, because that is simply what a tailor's daughter did. Now, let me tell you honestly what that work was, because I won't soften it for you. A tailoress in Dunedin in the 1880s did not sew for pocket money. She sewed because the alternative was not eating. Piecework, most of it. Paid by the garment, not the hour, which meant the factory owner never had to think about how long anything actually took, just how fast a woman could be made to go before her fingers gave out. The wages were set exactly where they needed to be to keep her coming back tomorrow. Not one shilling more. Employers weren't guessing at this. They knew precisely how thin a woman's other options were, and they priced her labor to that thinness. A living wage was never the target. The target was the lowest wage a body could still show up on. There was no dignity built into that arithmetic. None was needed. A hungry woman doesn't bargain, she sows. So on the 11th of July, 1889, when a group of these women gathered in the Dunedin Coral Hall to found New Zealand's first union of female workers, I want you to understand what a strange, almost impossible thing that was. Women who had been told in every wage packet that their labor was worth less than a man's, sitting down together and saying, "We disagree." Harriet was there. She didn't found it, but she gave herself to it completely. Vice president first, then secretary by 1890, a post she'd hold for 6 years. And gave herself isn't a figure of speech. In February of 1891, she went to Wellington to keep the branch there from falling apart. Later that year, Auckland. In 1892, she spent 26 weeks, half a year, living out of a trunk, rebuilding an Auckland branch that was one bad meeting away from collapsing entirely. This was not glamorous work. There was no crowd cheering her onto a stage. It was cold halls and small rooms and the same exhausting conversation over and over in city after city. Your labor has a price and you are allowed to name it. And it worked. She was largely responsible for winning something you could actually hold in your hand. A minimum weekly wage of 7 shillings 6 pence for clothing workers. Not a promise. Not a principle on paper. A number. In an actual pay envelope that hadn't been there before. I remember watching those women receive that first wage under the new floor, and understanding, in a way I don't think even they fully said aloud, this was the same fight as the one about to be won in the voting booth. Just fought in a room that smelled like machine oil instead of ink. Let me tell you what that union hall really was, underneath the meeting minutes and the wage tables. It was a room where a woman's word counted as evidence. Think about how rare that was. Outside those walls, a tailoress's opinion about her own life carried almost no legal or social weight at all. Inside the Coral Hall, on union nights, a woman could stand up and say, "This wage is unjust," and have that statement treated as something worth debating, worth organizing around, worth traveling 26 weeks to Auckland to defend. That is not a small thing. That is, in its own quiet way, a kind of sanctuary. Not from the world, but a foothold inside it. And Harriet understood, I think before most people around her did, that this foothold could not stay fenced off from the rest of a woman's life. The same women who deserved a fair wage also deserved a fair vote, and she never treated those as two separate causes running on parallel tracks. To her, they were the same insistence wearing two different coats. You can see it plainly in 1892 when Henry Fish ran for mayor of Dunedin. Fish was no small obstacle. He was Parliament's own spokesman for the liquor trade, and he stood dead against suffrage. Harriet led the women's campaign against him, not from a safe distance either, directly, publicly, in a city where a woman doing such a thing was still its own kind of scandal. And out of that fight came something new. With her friend Helen Nicol, she founded the Dunedin Franchise League, deliberately independent of the temperance movement it grew alongside. I want you to sit with that choice for a moment. She could have let suffrage shelter under someone else's banner. She built it its own house instead, a room that existed for exactly one purpose, women deciding for themselves what they were owed. Now, I promised I wouldn't spare you the harder part, and I won't spare you this one either. In 1896, the union dismissed her from the post she'd poured 6 years into. Two picnics meant to raise funds had failed through nothing but bad weather. A carnival's books came back untidy. And from that, untidy books, a rained-out picnic, grew a suggestion that she'd mismanaged funds, perhaps worse than mismanaged. There was never any evidence. None. What there was, most likely, was the oldest story in any organization. Infighting, looking for somewhere to land. I won't dwell in the injury of it, because Harriet herself didn't, but I won't pretend it didn't cut. Here was a woman who had spent her whole public life demanding that women be judged fairly, on real evidence, not on suspicion or convenience. And the very machinery she'd helped build turned that same unfair suspicion on her, without a shred of proof to stand on. That is what makes this moment matter spiritually, not just personally. It's easy to demand justice from people who are already against you. It is a far harder, far rarer thing to still believe in justice when it fails you from the inside, from the room you built with your own hands. Harriet didn't walk away bitter, and she didn't walk away quiet. she walked toward the next room where the work was needed. I imagine that was the truest test of what she'd actually believed all along. Not whether the union treated her fairly in the end, but whether she still meant every word she'd said about fairness, even after it wasn't extended to her. She did. You'll see exactly how in a moment. Here is what I think Harriet actually leaves behind once you step back far enough to see the whole shape of it. She proves simply by living it that the vote and the wage were never two different causes. History likes to file them separately. Suffrage in one chapter, labor rights in another, as if women wanted a ballot in one hand and a fair wage in the other, for two unrelated reasons. Harriet never lived that way. To her, they were the same demand, spoken in two different rooms. A country cannot call a woman's voice worthy of a vote, and her labor worth less than a man's in the same breath. Sooner or later, one of those has to give way to the other. And then watch what happens next in her own life, because I don't think it's an accident. In 1906, Harriet becomes the South Island's first female factory inspector. 2 years after that, she moves to Auckland to run a new women's branch of the Department of Labor entirely. The very kind of oversight she once needed, someone with real authority walking into a factory, asking whether a woman was being paid fairly and treated safely, she became that. Nobody handed her that answer from outside. She grew into being the answer herself. I find something quietly moving in that. Not triumphant, exactly. Just complete. A circle closing. And if you look past New Zealand, past this one woman, you'll find the same shape again and again. In tradition after tradition, culture after culture, the conviction that a soul's labor and a soul's voice cannot honestly be weighed on different scales. Harriet didn't invent that idea. Almost no one does. She simply refused to let it stay a slogan and spent her whole life turning it into an inspector's ledger, a union wage table, a franchise league with its own front door. That's the inheritance, not a monument, a method. Here is the part I most want you to sit with. There is a truth quietly running underneath everything Harriet did, and it isn't really about 1893 or New Zealand or even the vote at all. It's this. A right on its own is only ever a door. It doesn't finish anything by existing. Somebody still has to walk through it, and somebody still has to be standing on the other side, willing to actually change what happens next. Harriet understood that 130 years before you'd think to ask her. She could have stopped at the vote. So many people in so many countries have treated the ballot as the final word, as if once it's won, the story closes and everyone can rest. She never believed that. For her, the vote was simply the loudest door in a hallway full of quieter ones. The wage table, the union hall, the inspector's ledger. Walking through all of them was the actual work. The vote was just the one door history remembers to mention. I want to tell you something true about the world you're living in right now, gently, because I think you already feel it, whether or not you've said it aloud. That hallway isn't finished. It was never going to be finished in one generation or two or seven. The question of whether a woman's labor and a woman's voice are weighed the same as a man's is not a question that got settled in 1893 and filed away. It is still being decided in ordinary rooms, in pay envelopes, in whose word gets believed without a second thought, and whose gets quietly, politely doubted. You live inside that unfinished hallway. So did Harriet. So did everyone between you and her. Here is the part I find steadying, though, rather than discouraging. The outcome of this. The day a soul's labor and a soul's voice are simply weighed the same, without argument, without exception, isn't actually in doubt. Not to me. I've watched this pattern insist on itself in too many places, too many centuries, wearing too many different coats, to believe it's optional. What is not settled, what is genuinely still unwritten, is how long it takes and whose hands do the carrying in the meantime. And that's where you come back into the story. Because faith, real faith, was never a feeling you keep tucked away and admire on quiet evenings. It's a verb. It's what Harriet did every single time she got on a train to Wellington or Auckland or wherever the next union branch was quietly dying and needed someone stubborn enough to sit in the room and rebuild it. Nobody handed her a guarantee that it would work. She simply believed the outcome was coming and acted like it was already true, long before the world had caught up to agree with her. That is the only method that has ever actually existed for closing a hallway like this one. Not one grand vote, not one dramatic year, just person after person, generation after generation, choosing to walk through whatever door happens to be standing open in front of them, and doing the unglamorous work waiting on the other side of it. You don't need my permission to be one of those people. You already are. The moment you decide the wage table matters as much as the ballot box, and act like it. So let me ask you something, and then I'll leave you alone with it for a while. Where's your hallway? I don't mean the big door. The one everybody already agrees matters. The one that gets a monument or a memorial garden 100 years later. I mean the quieter ones down the corridor. The unglamorous room nobody's watching. The ledger nobody wants to double-check. The wage nobody's asked about out loud in years, because asking feels awkward, and awkward is so much easier to avoid than a real conversation. Harriet never got the big dramatic moment you'd put in a painting. No storming of a palace. Just 26 weeks in a half-collapsed Auckland branch, one exhausting meeting at a time. Just a ledger under her arm, walking into a room that didn't want her there. I wonder if you've got a room like that waiting for you right now. Not a cause you'd put on a banner. Just some small, specific place where you already suspect something isn't being weighed fairly, and you've been letting the awkwardness win. You don't have to fix the whole hallway. Harriet didn't. She just kept choosing the next door. What's yours? So that's Harriet Morrison. The same New Zealand, the same 1893 victory as Kate Shepherd, but reached through a factory door instead of a platform. That makes two doors now, out of seven. The seed, the network, the platform, and now the factory floor, all converging on the same year, the same small, stubborn country at the bottom of the world. Next time, we stay in that exact same New Zealand, in that exact same year, but we step through a third door entirely. And this one doesn't just ask for what the others asked for, this one asks for more. I want you to meet a Maori woman named Mary Mangakahia. In May of 1893, she stood up in front of a parliament of her own people, the first woman ever to do so, and didn't simply ask for the vote. She asked to sit in that parliament herself. She grounded the whole request in something the Pākehā suffrage movement had never quite reached for, a woman's own authority over her own land. Same seed, same soil even, in a way. But watch what grows when it takes root in ground that was never English to begin with. I can't wait for you to meet her. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.